Well, in case you haven't heard, folks, we are 18 days away from electing the leader of the free world and the president of the United States at the same time. The two candidates and the two parties have raised darn near every issue there is, and a few non-issues, too. But it is rare, from our journalistic point of view, that they discuss the importance of environmental issues. But once again, another election, at least from our perspective, where the environment is a relatively side issue, if that. Why? Well, it's one of the questions that we hope our panelists will address today in our election plenary, and we will also examine the distinctions between the two candidates and the two parties on energy and environmental issues. For the record, of course, we invited both the candidates for president. They did not respond. Not totally unexpected. They're a little on the busy side right now. But, of course, we do think they should be here because they are addressing the bulk of North America's journalists and reporters who cover issues of the environment and energy, all in one room at the same time. Nevertheless, we are so fortunate to have two terrific guests here today, and we're so grateful that they could be here. And I'd like to introduce both of them, and I want to explain to you the format, too, we're going to have. We've asked them to talk at their leisure for about 10 minutes or so on the issues that we've outlined. And then I'll ask one or two questions of each, and then we'll open it up for questions. First, let me introduce Al Armendariz. He's well known in Texas as a protector of the environment. He's now at the Sierra Club of Texas. He's a former director of the South and Southwest region for the Environmental Protection Agency. Of course, some of you may remember he resigned in April after, in a year-old video, he rather lightheartedly compared the EPA enforcement strategy to the Roman crucifixion. He says he regretted that, of course, but he stepped down a short time later. That set him on a new course in Texas. He's working with the Sierra Club as their senior campaign representative for the organization's Beyond Coal campaign. He's based in Austin. Dr. Armendariz, according to the posting on the Sierra Club website, draws on his scientific expertise working on air, water, and climate science to help move Texas off coal-fired electricity and toward an economy powered by job-generating clean energy sources such as wind and the sun, end quote. Dr. Armendariz is a father, he's a scientist, he's a third-generation Texan, who has spent much of his life protecting America's air and water and treasured landscapes, as the bio on the website says, as well as public health by working on transitioning society to a cleaner energy future. Ladies and gentlemen, Al Armendariz, welcome.
Thank you.
And now I'd like to introduce Congressman Randy Neugebauer. He is one of the Republican leaders in Congress, and we are guests here in his fine district that encompasses 27 counties, 29,000 square miles. Wow. He's one of the only congressmen that has frequent flyer miles within his district. He serves on the committee on, he's the chairman of the subcommittee on oversight and investigations for the Committee on Financial Services. He also serves on a science subcommittee. He is a surrogate for the Mitt Romney campaign, just spoke, as I said, in New Mexico yesterday or the day before. And he is a successful small business owner and a former head of the Texas Association of Builders. He's a proud graduate of Texas Tech University. Go Red Raiders. About 90 minutes now away from giving the TCU Horned Frogs a good old whooping. Yeah. Isn't it funny? When you come to Texas, you start talking like a Texan all of a sudden. It's just the strangest thing. And the congressman also married his high school sweetheart. His bio says one of his goals is to bring true Texas values to Washington, D.C. Congressman, we are so grateful to be guests here in your district. Thank you so much for having us and for agreeing to speak with us today. Thank you for being here. So I'm going to just, again, we're going to have comments from both of them, then I'll ask them just a couple questions each, then we'll open up to questions from the audience. Remember, SEJ's rules are SEJA members are those who get to speak, ask the questions first. And totally at random, Congressman, why don't you go ahead and give us a few words?
Okay. Is there a lava on? Turn this one on?
It's on.
Yep. Howdy. Now, come on, y'all can do better than that. Howdy. All right. Well, welcome to the 19th Congressional District. It's a pleasure for me to be here. I appreciate being included in this forum today, and also want to thank Dr. Kendall, who encouraged me to be a part of this. And as you've recognized him, he's a leader here, and you know he founded the Institute for Environmental and Human Health. And I think some of you are going to come out and visit that. Dr. Kendall and his folks are doing some remarkable work out there, and you're going to be very impressed. Well, when you landed in the 19th Congressional District, or West Texas, or the Big Country as we refer to it, I think you landed in one of the biggest working laboratories when it comes to agriculture, energy, and water in the country. And those of you that have already been out and know you've had a number of field trips, you've already realized that. I really can't think of an area in the country where you have so much diversity about so many issues that are not only just important to our country, but really these are issues that are important to the world. And I was noticing that the theme of your conference is big land, big sky, and big issues. And I know you can know by now you've landed in some pretty big country. And so we're delighted to have you here. And I think one of the things that is important about this area, when we talk about those three areas of the agriculture, energy, and water, that we foster, not only is this a great place to do research in these areas, but we've had a lot of entrepreneurial opportunities, and we've reaped the dividends of those entrepreneurial opportunities. I think the other thing that's important, particularly in Texas, that goes along with the successes that we've had is because of the fact that we've not only taken technological innovation, but we've also done it with smart regulation. And I think when you add those two together, what we found you get in Texas and in West Texas is you get economic growth in our community and in our country. And so I'd like to share with you now just a little bit of reflection on how the combination of resources and research and entrepreneurial opportunity have benefited this region and really benefited the country. First, I want to talk about agriculture, and obviously you figured out when you flew in here, you flew over a lot of farms. This is one of the most largest agricultural producing areas in our country. We produce, we're the largest cotton producing area in the country, and we're also one of the larger providers of livestock and beef in this country. And we've accomplished that, quite honestly, because of innovation and technological advances. When you think about what's happened in the country, today 98% of the people are fed by 2% of the people. So 2% of the people producing food for 98% of the people, and basically not only that 98, but also some of the people in the world. And one of the things we've seen in agricultural output in this country and in this area is that since 1948, we've increased the productivity of farming in this country almost 170%, while at the same time the inputs have remained the same, in some cases have diminished. And at the same time, in many cases, the prices have remained constant or those prices have gone down. And so Americans today they spend less for food than any other country in the world. Now, those challenges are going to persist in the future. We can't just rest on our laurels because we know that by 2050 that the population of the world is going to be 9 billion people. And so to feed 9 billion people, we're going to kind of have to keep the research and the entrepreneurial and the innovation going if we're going to meet that challenge. The other thing that I think that we have to make sure is that we have the political and the regulatory environment that fosters that kind of research and innovation and technology, and having the right balance to do that, because otherwise to meet those challenges of feeding those 9 billion people will be extremely difficult. You know, one of the things that you can't talk about agriculture and then not talk about water. Really, you can't talk about agriculture, and energy without talking about water. And water is precious in Texas. It's extremely precious in West Texas. But, you know, water issues are a global issue. And one of the things that we're doing in this area is we've made huge strides in, for example, irrigation efficiency. And our irrigation efficiency is about 95% today. In 2007, the value of our irrigated production in this country, or in Texas, for example, was $4.7 billion. We're getting smarter with our water. What we've found is that we're using about the same amount of water that we were using in the 1970s, but the output we're getting is we've doubled, for example, the yield on our cotton and corn crops in this region. So our farmers and ranchers and scientists have been extremely effective in coming up with new techniques of utilizing water, making sure that we're using it efficiently, but also making sure that we're doing it in an environmentally safe way. And so it's critical that we begin to push forward water issues in the future. I had, as I was sharing with someone a while ago, I actually had a classified briefing on water a number of months ago. And you would think, well, what would be a classified briefing on water? Well, if I could tell you, it wouldn't have been classified. But basically what it was, the basis of it is something that you know, is that water is a global issue. There's shortages of water in just about every country, major developing country and developed country in the world. The other issue that is important, and I think another reason that this is a great place to come and study this issue, is energy. And so basically the 19th Congressional District of West Texas, we're on the forefront of renewable energy in this part of the world. At the same time, we are on the cutting edge of new technology that is helping us produce traditional resources. And so basically when you talk about the all of the above energy policy, that is the policy here in West Texas, is we're looking at all of the energy alternatives. And obviously when you think about Texas, you think about oil. And yes, we are the largest oil producing state in the country. But did you also know that we're one of the top producers of clean natural gas in this country? And we have more wind energy capacity than any other state in the country. In fact, we are nearly a global leader in wind energy, and that's important. So I want to talk about what does all of that mean? You've got this laboratory here. You've got a great opportunity for research and entrepreneurial opportunities. And what does that translate to? Well, I want you to take you down 300 miles here from here to Dimmit County, Texas. 2 years ago in Dimmit County, Texas, they were one of the 20 poorest counties in the nation. Their unemployment rate was over 10.5%. Basically, their median income was half of what the state average was. What happened? Well, today in Dimmit County, there's jobs everywhere. Unemployment is 5%, obviously less than the national average. And why is that? Well, because of the Eagle Ford shale oil play down there. And what's happened because of that enhanced play down there, that they've created $20 billion annually, an economic opportunity not only for that county but for the surrounding counties, and created 40,000 full-time jobs. And how did they do that? Well, they did it with what we call around here fracking or hydraulic fracturing. And we've been doing that in Texas for a long time. We're just getting better at it, and a lot of that technology was developed here in West Texas. And not only have we been doing it for 60 years, but we've done it for 60 years without any groundwater contamination. So basically when you have the smart regulation coupled with the innovation, what did we get? Well, we got a lot of jobs, and we're getting a lot of energy that will help eventually to make America less energy dependent. I think the other thing I want to turn to then is the wind energy. And as I mentioned, we are one of the leaders in the country today in wind energy. And right now in Texas, wind energy is producing about 7% of the electricity in the United States of America. In just a few years, the projection is that that could be 20%. What's going on in this district and basically here at Texas Tech is a lot of very promising research. They have the Texas Wind Science and Engineering Research. And what they're studying is to help improve turbine designs for not only the wind patterns here in West Texas, but they're also doing research to help with turbines in other parts of the country where they have different wind patterns. The other thing that they're doing at Tech, and you may have been able to find out about this, is they have the scale wind farm technology, or the SWIFT facility. And basically, this is a facility that will allow the Texas Tech University to collaborate with other universities to measure wind flow, rotor design, and turbine interaction. Some interesting things that have happened in the wind energy business is that, for example, technology and innovation have reduced the cost per kilowatt by one-fifth in just in the last 10 years. And in the last 5 years, the turbine costs themselves have gone down by one-third. Another thing that I want to point to is a project that's in the 19th Congressional District that is basically a carbon sequestration facility. It'll be the first of its kind, and it's in the planning stages. And basically what we're doing is talking about building a coal-fired power plant. But what are we going to do? Well, we're going to capture all of the CO2 from that plant. We're going to compress it, and then we're going to pipe it over to the oil fields in West Texas, where we've been using CO2 to enhance oil recovery in this region for a number of years, and it's been proven to be very effective. Now, what does that mean? Well, it means we're going to take 17,000 tons of carbon or CO2, and we're not going to just put that in the atmosphere, but we're going to take it over and use that to produce 34,000 new barrels of oil every day for making America, again, less energy dependent. These are the kinds of things that I've hoped you've had an opportunity to learn while you were here and experience while you're here. And I would say that I'm very proud of what's going on here in my district, because when you look at these three important issues, a lot of people are focusing on the global financial picture in this that's going on right now here in our country domestically and internationally. But I would tell you that these three issues are huge issues as we look at what faces us in the near term and the long term of water, agriculture, and energy, and what we do about that and how we address those issues as a country and as a globe will make a determination of what lifestyle for our future generations are. I want to commend you again. Thank you for choosing Lubbock, Texas and Texas Tech to come and spend some time here. I hope that as you leave here and as I read articles that you or stories that you do in the future, that you'll be able to reflect back on some things that you found and learned while you were here in West Texas and in Lubbock, Texas. And so thank you for your attention, and thank you for allowing me to be here. God bless you, and may God bless the United States of America.
Good afternoon, everybody, and I want to thank SCJ for the invitation to be here today. And, you know, like the congressman, I want to welcome you to Texas, and thank you for being here. I grew up in El Paso, which, if you don't know Texas geography, is it's the westernmost point in Texas. It's part of that little triangle that tips under most of the state of New Mexico. And growing up, we used to get angry when people in Lubbock would call themselves West Texans, because if you want to drive to El Paso, you're looking at another probably 4 or 5 hours going west. For us, this was the beginning of Central Texas, but we'll fight over that some other time. I did want to talk about a couple of things, and as you may have gathered, either over interactions you've had with people like Randy and other Texans over the years, or maybe in the last few days since you've been here in Lubbock, Texans are very proud of their state. We have a tremendous history, a long tradition of excellence in many different fields, and so Texas, perhaps to the point of annoyance to people from the other 49 states, are very proud of where they come from and don't mind telling other people that. So what I thought I would do is just mention for a few minutes why I think it's important that you're here. And partly because as Texas goes, I do think so goes the rest of the country. And I wanted to touch on a couple of examples to really drive that point home. Some of you from the Northeast or from the Midwest know that after the 2010 census numbers were released, there was a lot of changes that happened to your congressional districts. You know, the seats that were lost, trying to put people together, incumbents who now have to run against each other. Well, as the congressman knows, thank you. We gained 4 seats here in Texas this year. We do have the fastest growing city anywhere in the country. The Dallas-Fort Worth metropolitan area is adding about 150,000 people a year. And then if you look at the fastest growing region of Texas, the far south tip of Texas, down on the end of the Rio Grande where it goes into the Gulf, the city of Brownsville, you start moving up about 4 or 5 counties to the town of Laredo. There's some other little cities in there you've probably never been to or maybe never even heard of, like McAllen and Harlingen and so on. Well, according to that census, in these 6 rural counties down there in South Texas, the population is 1.7 million people, which gives it the population of cities like Nashville and Rochester and other cities that you may have been to already. So the population of Texas is growing. It's growing rapidly. And it is something that folks in government, the congressman or myself during the time I was in government, are very much aware of. We have a fast-growing population. We have a growing need for things like water, fuel, and food and fiber. And so we're in a very, very dynamic and growing part of the country today. I'll give you a few other statistics. People in Texas have these. We know these like we know the members of our family. The Port of Houston. That one port exports about 20% of the gross domestic value of all of the exports that we produce in our country. They leave that one port down on the Texas Gulf Coast. So I could keep going on. But I hope I'm giving you a picture for really the economic engine that the state of Texas provides, both for our own people, but really for the country overall. This also is a fantastic place to be if you're thinking about agriculture. Agriculture has been one of the real bright spots. Even after the financial collapse, even after the recession, there was one industry in this country that continued to prosper and to continue to grow year after year after year, and that was agriculture. In fact, under President Obama, the last 3 years have been the highest in terms of export value of American agriculture than any 3-year period in American history. So we've reached all-time records in terms of export growth. And that's even with the hits that we took because of the drought. And so if you're interested in agricultural issues, if you're interested in water issues, you are really in the best place to study those kinds of issues. You're also in a fantastic place if you write about water. People in Texas sometimes get upset that the media in this country is somewhat biased. You know, things aren't real news, it seems like, unless it's happening in Washington or New York sometimes. So this year there's a lot of attention on the drought. You know, the 2012 drought has become a national news. You see it everywhere. Flyers, you see it in many of your newspapers and TV reports. The drought really started in 2011, and it hit the state of Texas like a ton of bricks. We didn't get a drop of water, I think, from Amarillo down to Brownsville for about 15 months, starting in late 2010 all the way through early 2012. And I think the congressman and I know that regardless of where you went in Texas, it was in 2011, there were lots of issues on people's mind, but issues 1 through 9 were water, 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 and water, because we weren't getting any. And it was the driest year that Texas has ever had. It is our driest year of record now. It was also the hottest year we've ever had. And sometimes those things don't overlap, and sometimes they get confused in the media. But we had not only the driest year we've ever had in 2011, but we had the hottest year we ever had in 2011. And those two things on top of each other caused all kinds of problems in our state, including agriculture that was beginning to get stressed. We had record losses in things like cattle. And poultry, and in addition, we had problems keeping the lights on. It's good you're here in October. I love it when people come to Texas, but you get a very different experience if you're here in July or August. It is unbelievably hot, and everybody's inside with the air conditioning running. And when that happened in 2011, after we hit about 90 consecutive days in most of the state above 100 degrees for highs and about above 80 degrees for the lows at night, We had a very hard time keeping the lights on. We just simply didn't have enough power to provide all the electricity that our growing state needed. And so so if you're interested in water issues, this is certainly a place to be. And one thing where I think water and agricultural issues overlap is really in the area of climate change. You know, we're going to struggle here in Texas if what happened in 2011 and also in 2012, we still are way below normal when it comes to rainfall. If that becomes our new norm, you know, whether it's Lubbock or El Paso or out in East Texas, if we get 10 years in a row like the last 2 years, we will have economic challenges and infrastructure challenges in Texas that are really going to be unmatched. And so so climate change is a huge issue. I think it's the number one environmental issue, not only globally, not only in our country, but here in Texas. The 2011 drought and 2011 heat wave, for me, were really a wake-up call, that there really is no other more important issue in Texas than climate change, because our state simply cannot sustain itself the way it is if we have a decade, let alone several decades, that are like 2011. If that's the new norm, we're going to be in a lot of a lot of hurt. And kind of along those lines, I did want to, and then I'll go ahead and pass it, pass the mic so we can get into some Q&A. I wanted to read you a couple of quotes. So here's one. So there's a quote that says, CO2 emissions must be reduced to avoid serious climate change. Government action is needed, and we support an international framework that puts a price on CO2. As was said, I worked at Sierra Club, or I work at Sierra Club, used to work at EPA, but that's a statement you can actually find on the Royal Dutch Shell website. That's their corporate position. Read you another one, Duke Energy. So Duke Energy, you might not know, the largest utility in the United States. They're the largest CO2 emitter in the United States. Their statement is, among those scientists actively working and publishing in the legitimate scientific journals, there is very little doubt around the basic points that the Earth is warming and that increasing concentrations of greenhouse gases are largely responsible. Climate change is occurring, and that human interaction with the environment is responsible. And so before I pass the microphone over to you, I did want to reiterate the need for there to be a challenge to the American people. The American people are still confused. I think for the first time maybe ever, a majority of them believe that climate change is happening. That's still very depressing for folks who are in the scientific community, or for folks who watch the environment. That would be like a majority of Americans believing the sun's going to come up tomorrow. You know, that it's a very low bar is what I'm saying. There's no scientific dispute that climate change is real and that it's happening, and that it can have serious consequences to Americans. And so so my challenge to you is to cover the issue and to cover it fairly. And when I say fairly, it doesn't mean you have the climate change proponent and the skeptic from the Cato Institute and you put them on television and you confuse everybody. If you were to do that proportionally with the number of scientists who still doubt climate change, you'd run probably about 99 stories about climate change without putting on anybody who has a skeptical position. And that's about the degree, that's what I would call fair. You know, people don't talk about smoking and the dangers of smoking, or whether the government should put pictures of people who have, you know, smoking-related illnesses and put the one physician who's still out there who doesn't believe smoking causes cancer on television, that it isn't done anymore. And we are at the point where we do need to treat climate change skeptics with the same kind of scorn that we treat those remaining physicians who still hold the point and still hold the belief that smoking doesn't cause cancer. That's the level of marginalization that those people deserve, and that's the marginalization degree that you should give them. So with that, I will... I'll conclude, and thank you again for the invitation.
Check, check, check. Thank you very much, Doctor. Congressman, you were talking a lot about wind energy and how Texas is really the leader in the country, if not the world, in wind energy, and West Texas is probably at the core of that. And it's created so many jobs. The governor, Rick Perry, says, I think, 55,000 jobs related, at least indirectly. What about tax credits? How do you feel about that, when the vast majority of government credits and incentives are going to the gas and oil industry in Texas? Why shouldn't they also be extended to wind energy and other alternative energies? Is the mic on? Let's check. It's looking green up here. Back there, we have an audio person somewhere. I'll give you this mic while we get it fixed. Go ahead and leave it on if you would.
Well, thank you for that question. You know, one of the things that we do in many times to kind of stimulate and to incubate, solutions in our country is we use tax credits to do that. We use tax credits for a lot of different things. We use it for housing. We use it for other types of resources. And, I have supported the production tax credits in the past. But I think one of the things that we have to be very careful with is that we use the tax policy to distort what would be the market determination of the value of these alternatives. And so certainly the wind industry has gotten very mature. I think it is. We're approaching a time now where even people in the wind industry tell me that, it's probably we're moving towards a direction where we should, begin to phase out the wind tax credit, the tax credits, production tax credits, and let the marketplace determine what the value and the viability, long-term viability of that energy resource is.
And what about the government support and credits and tax incentives for the oil and gas industry then? Get rid of those two?
Yeah, well, I think one of the things that you have to look at in the oil and gas industry, and a lot of people get confused about that, some of those are not tax credits, but they are basically accounting treatments. For example, there's how they amortize certain costs, for example, and intangible drilling costs, for example. That's a cash outlay that they make, and so the question is, do they capitalize that, or are they able to write that off in a shorter period of time? So one of the things that I think we're going to do as a nation, whether it's oil and gas or whether it's wind or some of these other, is we're headed to a point where we're going to have to, determine, what the tax policy is in this country. Many of us, including myself, have supported a simplification of the tax code, lowering the marginal rates, but at the same time, doing away with the government picking winners and losers and basically using tax policy to reward some people and punish others. But I think we have to do that in a comprehensive way. And we're probably going to have that discussion probably sooner than later, because basically we've got a fiscal crisis in this country. We got a country that's spending 40 for every dollar it spends, it's borrowing 40 cents. We're on our fourth and headed to our fifth $1 trillion deficit. These are not sustainable. And so I think we're going to be looking at both sides of the ledger. We're going to have to be looking at the tax policy side of the ledger. We're also going to have to be looking at the spending side of the ledger.
And while I ask him a question, go ahead and put your mic back up on your tie. And if we could get our friend from the Overton to check the microphones, that would be great if somebody could do that for us. Dr. Armendariz, we've just struggling to still get out of the worst recession since the Great Depression. The critics of environmental regulation have said and will say, if there was ever a time to ease up on environmental regulations so that we can do even more to create jobs and keep this economy alive, now would be the time to do it. Do you disagree with that?
I do, yes. Am I going on?
Nope. Well, okay.
So, I do disagree. And that's principally because environmental regulation has a tremendous track record of being more than cost effective and actually creating economic value to the country and creating economic value to individual businesses. The environmental regulations that were being promulgated when I was at EPA more than paid for themselves. So for every dollar that would be required to put on a scrubber or every dollar required for pollution controls, there were $3, $4, $5, $10 that were saved in terms of healthcare costs to the country. So certainly some of these regulations might cost an individual company a certain amount of capital to put on new, cleaner pollution controls, but the overall value to society goes up. when the water's cleaner and children don't get sick because there's lingering sewage or bacteria in the water that they're drinking, or if a scrubber gets put on and children don't get asthma attacks and can't go to school, and so their parents have to stay home, take care of their children, and have to call in sick at work. I think the Clean Air Act, the Clean Water Act, in addition to being tremendous in terms of environmental protection, are economic development statutes. The economy of this country has grown tremendously since the 1970s, and pollution has gone way down. And so I don't see a contradiction at all in having robust environmental protection and at the same time stimulating economic growth.
Congressman, there's been a fascinating dialogue among conservative religious leaders about God's planet, God's gift here. Some have said that we should protect what God has created more robustly. Others have said that that it's there for humans to use, that God wants us to use these natural resources. Where does the truth lie? What does the Bible say in your view?
It says it's on, but the scriptures say too much is given, much is expected, and I think that we have a responsibility to be good stewards of the earth. And I think when you landed in one of the biggest laboratories in the country when you came here, and nobody understands how precious this land is and the water resources than the farmers and ranchers of West Texas. And they're probably, and maybe a little prejudiced here, but I think they're the greatest environmentalists in the country, is because not only are they making their living from the land, but they're raising their families on the land. And so, they're not going to do things that would be harmful to the land, and they're certainly not going to do things that are harmful to their families. And so I think there shouldn't be a lot of disagreement on the stewardship that we owe for the privilege of living here on this planet. I think what we have is in many cases a little bit of a disagreement on how much man is impacting what's going on. Then the question is when we determine, with real science that man is making an impact, then the second question is then what is the appropriate steps to minimize that or remediate that? And I think there are kind of two different philosophies out there. There are people that think, this is a good thing. Let's figure out and do it in the best way, an environmentally friendly way. But then there are those, unfortunately, out there that think that all of these activities are bad, and they're basically trying to terminate these activities. And quite honestly, I don't think that was the intent. That's the intent for us being here. But I think we have to do it in a responsible way.
All right, so here, let's get the 800-pound gorilla on the table here. What about climate change? Do you disagree with thousands and thousands and thousands of independent scientists around the world who say that man is the primary cause of climate change?
Well, I think one of the things that I've had an opportunity as a member of Congress to sit on the Science Committee, sit on the Agriculture Committee, and so I've been around a lot of the scientists that are doing studies in this way. I've been to the South Pole. We have a tremendous amount of research going on at that facility down there. I've actually had an opportunity to have a dialogue with those scientists, and I think here's what we agreed on when I was there, is that the climate is changing. But the climate has changed from the very beginning to this point. So planet's been warmer, it's been cooler, it's been warmer, it's been cooler, and so there's a cycle. Does everybody know exactly what causes that cycle? No, they don't. So I think we all agree. I think where there tends to be disagreement in the scientific community, as they talk to me, is how much impact man is actually having on this climate change. Because way before we had coal-powered plants, way before we had gas-fired plants, way before we had the combustion engine, we had a warmer climate than we have now. And so the question is, and It's the you said the 800-pound gorilla in the room. The question is how much of what's going on today are we actually impacting? And what if we do change our behavior or we continue to do things in an environmentally friendly way, will that really have a significant impact on what the change is going on now, or is this just a normal evolutional part of the climate on this little planet called Earth?
You might get a question or two about that coming up. Doctor, the polls suggest that a good chunk of the American people agree with Democrats on so many environmental issues, even climate change. Not that you're a political creature in terms of campaigning, but you were a former government official. You know the ins and outs of these kinds of things. Why isn't the president's campaign, and for that matter other Democrats, talking more about environmental issues?
Sure. You know, those of us who are here in this room, we spend all day thinking about environmental issues. It's our job, so we're getting paid to do environmental work. You do environmental reporting. I do environmental advocacy. I used to be an environmental regulator. Most people don't. You know, even my wife. You know, she might spend an hour a week, and that's probably when she's doing the recycling or taking the recycling out. So, you know, when you look at the polls, at least the ones I've seen of the most important issues that that people are, you know, things that people are thinking about today. They're thinking about their jobs. They're thinking about the economy. They're thinking about you know, they're thinking about women's rights issues. They're thinking about immigration. You know, down here in Texas, people think about the particular industry that you're in, whether it's layoffs at NASA or it's the drought if you're a cotton farmer, which is very natural. You know, I think, and so it doesn't surprise me that most of what the politicians are talking about are not environmental issues. I think it would be kind of unusual for them to take on an issue and talk a lot about an issue that's not really front and center with the American people. Like for example, foreign policy, you know, what happened in Benghazi, what happened at the embassy. Certainly an incredible tragedy, very important issue to the ambassador's family, to the people at the State Department, and so on. Most of the American people are not waking up every morning wondering who knew what the day that happened, although there is a news channel that is trying to make that the most important issue for the American people. It simply isn't. So I think similarly, environmental regulation, environmental protection, not something most American people wake up and worry about. I do think that places a high responsibility on the people whose job it is to do environmental work, the regulators, the people at EPA, the people in the state agencies, Railroad Commission, all these other agencies that do environmental work, to do the job that they're being paid to do.
Well, real quickly, a brief answer if you could, and we'll go to Tim for the first question. Do you think, though, that some Democratic consultants are saying, look, we know Democrats, we've got Democrat voters already, they're our base. What we're really interested in is appealing to independent voters, and therefore some of these green issues might not appeal?
Perhaps. You know, I'm not involved in the current campaign, so it's hard for me to know. That would be one possibility. But I suspect a bigger push is they've done polling on what are the five or six major issues that are going to unify the base and win independent voters. And I suspect it's been jobs, it's been the economy, it's been reproductive rights. It's, you know, and so as much as they can, they're going to focus their candidate to talk about those issues. And then these other issues, I suspect foreign policy, environmental issues, those are simply too far down the list to make it up to the four or five things that someone can talk about in a stump speech. And I think I suspect that's probably what happens. Last thing I'll say is, you know, there are times where the candidates, I do see them talking about energy issues in particular, and insofar as energy and environmental issues are tied together, then that's where obviously part of the environmental debate comes in. But even there, I suspect it's more because in that particular community, it's tied to like a local jobs issue rather than an environmental concern.
It's interesting to bring that up. The platforms from the two candidates, the president has a rather a wide-ranging environmental stance on environmental issues. Mitt Romney's website and campaign have stances on energy issues and not on environmental issues. So that energy is front and center to their campaign, the environmental issue. Let's go ahead and state who you are, who you work for, and questions only, no speeches or statements. Tim?
Okay. Hi, I'm Tim Wheeler, a reporter with the Baltimore Sun. The question is to the congressman, coming off of your last statement. I've been covering these issues for a little while, just a preliminary to the question. And it's been interesting to see how the debate, if you will, about climate change has evolved over time. Beginning back in the early 90s, there was a debate about whether it was happening, whether it could happen. That seems to have changed now, and those who are opposed to doing anything about it argue essentially that it's natural, it's not man-made, and that there's nothing you can do about it. There's another principle that's pretty widely accepted, across all political parties, and that's one of sustainability. And that when something is, one achieves sustainability, and when there are factors that you can't control, then you control those that you can. That's certainly the principle that's applied in fisheries management. And so I have to ask you, even if you go with your philosophy that this is not a man-made phenomenon, that it's natural, man-made carbon dioxide and other gases are contributing to that change. There is no doubt about the greenhouse effect. Nobody debates that. So would you not think that there's a federal role in trying to limit that as much as possible?
Well, we passed the Clean Air Act and the Clean Water Act to address what we felt like were two major environmental issues in this country a number of years ago. One, we had the smokestacks that were, billowing black pillars of smoke into the atmosphere. We had, companies had a pipe upstream bringing in fresh water and a pipe downstream, putting their waste. So I think the question is, if we know some of these things could be potentially harmful and contributing to, climate change in this country, should we do something about it? And I don't think there's any disagreement. Yes, we should do something about it. And I think the carbon CO2 sequestration project that I was talking about, and it was a point I was trying to make a while ago, there are some people that want to be terminators, and then there are some people that want to be facilitators. And I think the more positive thing, because we do need more energy for this generation and the future generations. And so how do we go about doing that? Well, we should leave ourselves a lot of options. So where we have opportunities to do it more environmentally friendly, I think we should do that. Here's the real question, though. In many cases, sometimes it is not economically feasible to initiate some of the remediation that some people want to do. And so that then eliminates some of the options. If there are not other options to take that place, then we begin to work ourselves into somewhat of a box. And so long term, what we have to do is look at solutions that are, make economic sense, that people can afford, that we do them in the most environmentally friendly way that we can. But with the same token, that we have in a political environment, in a regulatory environment that becomes facilitatory, and not an environment where we have people telling us, no, don't do this anymore. There are folks out there that just don't want us to be doing anything that has anything to do with hydrocarbons. But those are the same people that fly up to Washington in a jet, rent a car at the airport and drive over. In other words, we to eliminate CO2 in this country, basically you have to almost eliminate hydrocarbons in this country. But I do support nuclear. I do support wind. I do support some of these alternatives. But at this particular point in time, those aren't a substitute for all of the needs that we have for energy in our country. And so we have to do it in a smart way, but we certainly have to do it in a way that's the most environmentally friendly that we can.
Mark? I'm Mark Schlefstein. I'm a reporter with NOLA.com and the Times-Picayune in New Orleans. My question has to get you guys back to Dimmit and fracking, and it has to do with the debate at the presidential level over the role of the federal government in determining our energy future. In the Eagle Ford Foundation, in recent years, there are significant resources being put into development of that resource. by CNOOC, the Chinese national company, by Stat Oil from Norway, and by other companies that are run by foreign governments. I'm wondering how that fits into this idea that fracking is going to make us energy independent if all of these resources are going to be moved offshore.
Who's the question for, Mark? Either one?
My question is how do we...
Which one?
It's for both of you, actually.
I'm happy to go first, sure. So I do think energy independence is a good idea, but I agree with perhaps the premise of the question, which is we do need to be careful about who owns our energy sources. There is an agency right now that regulates our nuclear industry, the Nuclear Regulatory Commission. They get very nervous about foreign ownership of our nuclear power plants in this country, and they have for a very long time. I think they see that as a potential national security issue. And so I do think it's prudent for us to be careful about other countries owning any part of our energy sector. I think that's wise. I do think that we shouldn't have a knee-jerk reaction to it. I think foreign investment in our country is a very good thing. American companies go around the world and develop energy and develop manufacturing. American companies have built manufacturing plants in China, perhaps to our detriment. And so I don't think it's a bad thing if foreign companies want to come and invest in our country and give Americans jobs and produce American energy. I think overall that's not a bad idea. But should we have some government oversight about foreign entities coming into this country and owning significant portions of our energy mix? I think that's probably a very prudent thing to do.
Congressman?
Well, you know, I think fracking is just a tool, we've been using it in Texas for over 60 years to enhance the recovery of oil. And I'm not a geologist, but there's some formations that are tighter than others, and so they require some manipulation of that formation to make the drilling of that well economic. In many of the states, the state of Texas has been monitoring in this process for 60 years, and I said we've not had groundwater contamination. So, you know, whether the federal government needs to have policy, I'm not sure that that's necessary. The industry obviously has a lot at stake when they're doing these kinds of procedures, because if they do have a bad outcome, obviously it impacts the whole industry and it impacts that individual company. So what I get afraid of is when we start trying to nationalize everything, certain things, is we're assuming that everything is the same. So that means that that the fracking formations that are going on in Pennsylvania are the same as the fracking of formations in Texas. Again, I'm not a geologist, but I'm told that those are different types of formations and different techniques are having to be used. I'm not a big supporter of the government stepping in and making very things prescriptive. It's not working in a lot of other areas, and certainly would be concerned about stifling the innovation that's currently going on, where we have made significant strides towards making this country more energy independent just in the last 3 or 4 years.
Robert.
Hi, I'm Robert McClure with Investigate West in Seattle. Jeff, I was glad that you framed one of your questions in terms of our stewardship of God's creation, and that's where my question comes from. Those of us who have covered climate change for a while have watched as the concentration of CO2 in the atmosphere has gone past what we were told was something of a red line, 350 parts per million. We are now on a trajectory in this country and globally to go much, much higher to levels that we are told are going to drive very destructive trends for our species. And so I hope you're familiar with the concept of bioengineering. That is the concept that we need to do large-scale experiments. They would essentially be experiments at first, to keep the atmosphere cooler. And we've all heard about, I think, putting iron into the ocean so it would absorb more CO2. There's ideas about basically large umbrellas flying around I know it sounds silly, but it's true. So here's my question, and it's for both of you. Congressman, if what we're going through is a natural cycle, and let's say it's a mixture, but it's, let's just say maybe it's largely natural, should we, as a species, to preserve ourselves, be doing bioengineering? I'm going to posit that we should. And Mr. Armendariz, I'd like to hear what you have to say about that as soon. Shouldn't we be doing bioengineering? Shouldn't we be thinking very hard about it right now?
Well, I think bioengineering is a pretty broad term, and again, I'm not a scientist, but what I do know is that we're doing a lot of bioengineering. I mean, I go back to the agricultural industry. They're doing a lot of different things to make, for example, crops more drought resistant, so that they require less water, require less pesticides, require, and so I think all of those kind of things make sense.
Not to interrupt, that's not what I'm talking about. I'm talking about large-scale global type operations. Geoengineering. I'm sorry, I misspoke. Okay. Geoengineering is what I meant to say.
Okay,
I beg your pardon.
Those are two different.
They're very different. Geoengineering, large scale alterations of the large scale attempts to control climate.
Yeah. Well, you know, I'll have to really kind of say that on that issue, I've really not taken a look at a lot of the different alternatives out there. So if I were to speak on that, I'd be making up something, and it's not my habit to make up.
No, I'm just asking you, if it's a natural cycle, should we try to stop it?
Well, I don't think we should try to stop natural cycles, no, because I don't think we can actually stop natural cycles, but that's just my personal opinion.
How?
Okay, so the vast majority of the science is telling us it's not a natural cycle. So I think the fact that CO2 is at a million-year record, you know, at about almost 400 parts per million, and we're now seeing heating and drought because of it. I do think that's all contributed by human activity. But I don't think geoengineering is a good idea, and I'll tell you why. It was oversight by engineers that got us into this mess. You know, when we began the wide-scale use of fossil fuels in the Industrial Revolution, people at the time didn't appreciate that the CO2, which was just being released into the atmosphere, was going to severely damage the planet. Now, there were a few scientists early on who recognized the dangers that all of this use of coal in the Industrial Revolution might pose, but it was not well understood until the mid part of the 20th century. So my answer is this: I think putting iron in the oceans, I think putting particles in the atmosphere, putting umbrellas to bounce the solar rays off, those are bad ideas because we have no idea what the 100 other consequences of those actions might be and whether those could be even more severe and more catastrophic than the pickle we currently find ourselves in. And so I think it's unnecessary. The use of coal historically for decades bounced around 50% in this country, going back generations, 50, 52, 54, 49. It is plummeting today. Coal is the largest source of CO2 in the atmosphere. We're down to the mid-30s. Last couple of years, the use of coal in this country has absolutely plummeted. We just need to keep that line going, and we're done. I'm very optimistic about the climate problem, and I don't think we need geoengineering to solve it. I think we need more wind energy and more electric cars, and I think
all right,
we're there.
Good. Chuck, by the way, the congressman's staff needs to get him out of here in a few minutes, so we'll try to wrap it up as quickly as we can.
Good afternoon. I'm Chuck Quernbach of Wisconsin Public Radio. What key environmental or energy issues would be affected if the U.S. Senate would tip Republican for both guests?
Well, we're going to find out in just a few weeks. You know, I think it's interesting because I think for many of us, when we're talking about water, when we're talking about energy, when we're talking these issues in agriculture, I always think we're talking in the same tense about the environment because, as I said a while ago, they go hand in hand, and the economic viability of any entity that's participating in any of those areas
really depends on, you know, the right balance from an environmental standpoint. I think one of the things that we do have to do, and we haven't been able to do, in both a Republican and a Democratic administration, is we do need to, you know, I think come to some agreement in this country. What is our energy policy going to be moving forward? Right now, we don't really have a comprehensive energy strategy in this country. And so basically, we've been doing it on a hodgepodge basis and really without any, I think, given anything for a long-term strategy. And so I think the number one thing that hopefully would happen, and I don't know whether it will happen or not, but if the Senate does go Republican and we have a Republican House and a Republican a president, then I think it's incumbent upon us, whether either party really, but it's incumbent on either party in control there to basically give the American people, you know, some kind of a long-term energy strategy.
Al?
Yeah, so there have been 302, I think, votes in Congress, the vast majority of them starting in the House, to roll back protections under the Clean Air Act and the Clean Water Act. Because of the good work of the Sierra Club and its allies and the Democrats as well, there have been 302 failures in the last session to roll back the Clean Water Act and Clean Air Act protections. So I don't take for granted what a switch in the Senate would bring. I think many of these very bad ideas to roll back environmental protections died in the Senate. And so I think having a GOP majority in the Senate would make maintaining those protections harder. And certainly a change in the Senate coupled with a change in the White House would be, I think, very bad for environmental protection. I think if the House's efforts had succeeded the last few years, you would have seen wholesale rollbacks in many of the environmental protections. And so now, with all that doom and gloom, I obviously and understandably have a different position than the congressman, that I'm optimistic that both the White House and the Senate will stay in Democratic hands. And so I don't think that doom and gloom scenario is going to happen. I think, if anything, after this election, we're all going to wake up and we're going to have another 4 years, a lot like the previous 4 years, with a divided Congress and a Democratic president. And so I think we'll have pretty much the status quo the next couple of years as we've had the past few years.
Sure, we've had lots of time. Just one more question over here.
Hi, my name is Mike Sorahan with E&E Publishing, and I have a question. It's more about drilling, I guess, really, than fracking, and it's for Dr. Armendariz. As you well know, you brought the case against Range Resources in Parker County over the Safe Drinking Water Act. Why did EPA drop that case?
Okay, so the best available data that I was presented by my staff indicated that that driller's natural gas was ending up in private drinking water wells. And I've not seen and did not see when I withdrew our enforcement action anything to the contrary. But we do live in a very litigious society, and the range enforcement case found itself in multiple federal courts, both at the district level and at the appellate level at the Fifth Circuit, and it was in the courts for more than a year, going on two. And so I felt that a better course of action would be to talk with Range about a potential settlement where we would withdraw our enforcement action and they would commit to doing additional monitoring in Parker County, Texas. Both of those things happened, I'm not there, so I haven't seen the latest results from that additional monitoring that they've done in Parker County.
If I could follow with a yes or no question, was that your decision or was it made at some other level?
No, it was mine. Yeah. I haven't seen the latest results from the Parker County data that Range committed to do, but a well-placed FOIA might get it out of the agency. So
they have a standing request.
Ladies and gentlemen, let's thank these two guests for being here and for answering some very frank questions and being good enough guests to come here. Thank you both very, very much. We love being in your district, too. Thank you.